Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Chers auditeurs,
dear listeners,
bonjour.
Welcome in Comme d'Archie podcast season 4.
Saison 4, dans le monde fascinant des architectes.
And in the architectural projects.
Je suis Anne-Charlotte Deponte, passionnée d'architecture et docteur des universités en histoire de l'archi.
I am one of the spokespersons of Anne-Charlotte, who is a PhD in architecture history.
Merci.
Thank you.
D'être avec moi aujourd'hui.
To be with us today.
Et
and
maintenant,
now,
lundi en français, place au talent.
And Wednesday, let's talk projects. In English, of course.
Bienvenue dans Comme d'Archie.
Chers auditeurs,
dear listeners, it's a pleasure to meet you today with Jeff Covell of Skylab.
Bonjour Jeff.
Hello Jeff, and welcome to Comme d'Archie. You are the founder of the American architectural firm Skylab. Your office is based in Portland, Oregon, USA. Thank you very much for your presence for this remote interview in Comme d'Archie.
Comme d'Archie.
You are the architect of the massive Serena Williams Nike World HQ, for example, but also much more intimate projects and projects in timber. We will come back to that. First, why the name of Skylab?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here with you. Skylab was founded in a house overlooking the city of Portland, and city of Portland is known for its dramatic weather. So we had a studio that had a very long, almost Bauhaus style window overlooking the city, and we used to watch storms kind of roll through the city, and it was quite inspiring. And we found that being up where you could sort of see the weather versus being underneath the weather was also a great vantage point. And so we were looking for a name, and we actually had an event and had a naming contest at the event, and somebody had written that one down the board, and all the folks in the room really responded to it, not only because of the sort of vantage point that we had, but also because of its sort of optimistic blue sky thinking references, sort of futuristic kind of references, and also, you know, what we like to refer to as a bit of sarcasm, because the Skylab actually crashed and burned and dropped into Earth out of orbit. So it's, you know, an optimistic lookout, but with a hint of irony.
Intéressant. Alors, commençons par le début.
Let's start at the beginning. What is your background? How was your childhood? Where did your desire for architecture take roots? What did you study? When and how did you start your activity?
Avez-vous commencé votre activité d'architecte?
Great. So, that's a lot of questions. I grew up in Rye, New York, which is a town about 45 minutes north of Manhattan on the east coast of the United States. And when I was about 7 years old, I was really fortunate to be a part of the design and construction of a custom residence for my family. My parents hired a young architect at the time named Steve Haas, and he was quite progressive. This was in like 1980 or 1982, something like that. And he designed really a brilliant home. And I was spending time, you know, in the meetings with my parents, looking at the model that he made. And then fortunately on site, you know, once a week about, I would go and walk around the construction site with my parents. And I was just completely taken by the contractors and the tools, and, you know, for a sort of Lego obsessed, young adult, like seeing it all go into full scale was really quite, powerful. So really, you know, at that moment, I was not that I was thinking about what I wanted to do with my life, but I was very, very much enraptured by construction and design. And And then I grew up in a house that really was the sort of next level from an architectural point of view. It was a piece of architecture that really helped you kind of interpret the place and the way that the daylight moved through the building and the rooms were oriented to the views and just the living style and plan. It was just really impactful. And so I think I really got to experience the power that architecture can have on your life when it's done well. And so, you know, I was one of those people that really knew what I wanted to do from a really young age and set out on sort of as fast a course as possible to achieve that goal. When I was in high school, I went and studied at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, at their summer architecture program. And then that helped me get accepted there for a university bachelor program. So I went there after college and did a 5-year architecture program, received a bachelor's of architecture there. And while I was there, I was spending summers out in the West Coast of the United States or the mountains, Colorado and Portland. And mostly because I had a passion for nature and the outdoors. And I also needed a break from the academic environment. And so I would do construction and really just explore the outdoors. And those are all really kind of important tenets for kind of who I am and my process and thinking and approach to architecture. So one of the things that I did when I was really young, also in high school, is I ended up working for the contractor that built the house I grew up in for a couple of summers. And so I really started on this sort of combined construction and design interest. And it's something that I think is a really important piece of education for any architect. And when I graduated from college, I moved to Colorado. I was working for an architect there. And I, you know, mostly we were working on sort of large log cabin mansions and log influenced hotels. And, you know, I was in the place I wanted to be, but I wasn't doing the work that I was interested in. And so I left Colorado to move to Portland, where I'd also spent a summer, because I saw it as a burgeoning city that had a really great proximity to both the coast and the mountains and a culture that was sort of infused by nature and trees and the watershed. And so I came here and I set up shop and went out to look for work. And at that time, it was not a very good economy in Portland. And so I ended up getting a role as a design build architect and contractor. And it ended up being a great blessing. So I spent about a year and a half working in both design and construction together before I got my first architecture-specific employment in Portland. The first job I got in Portland was for an architect, and his main client was Lenny Kravitz, the musician. And so I started working from there on Lenny's homes and music studios, as well as sort of retail and trade show and hospitality projects. And very shortly moved to Miami to build Lenny Kravitz's house in Miami in that kind of combined design and construction role. And after about a year and a half there, moved back to Portland. And at that time, I was 26 years old. I had satisfied the requirements for me to take the architecture licensing exam in the United States. And I decided to set out and start my own company. And that's how Skylab was born.
Bravo. Quelle richesse.
What richness in your career.
Alors, l'une de mes
One of my recurrent questions in Comme d'Archie is, do you feel today that you have accomplished what you imagined when you left school?
Right. Yeah. So the way I would answer that question is, you know, when I was looking at my career path. I was actually quite conflicted as a sort of high school student. At that time in my life, I was really becoming enlightened to a lot of the environmental challenges that were facing the world. And I was quite idealistic at that moment. And I really felt like there was an inherent tension between being an architect and, you know, using, extracting resources and deploying resources and sort of contributing to the sort of proliferation of development around the world. And, you know, what I saw as, you know, one of the problems we were facing, which was exactly that, the proliferation of development around the world and the destruction of nature. And so I struggled with that for a long time. And what I sort of came up with as my own internal rationale was that, you know, development's bound to happen and we needed to start doing it in a more sensitive and thoughtful way. And that I could play a role in shepherding that process along. And so from that point of view, you know, it's been a Skylab started in 1999. So we're about 24 years into our firm's history. And, you know, for the first, 10 years or so, I feel like we were really just trying to tackle projects and make a name for ourselves. And we had relatively limited resources in terms of making a significant environmental contribution. And then as our firm grew and our projects grew, we really started to be able to make significant contributions in that manner. And about 20 years in, you know, we started working on a book about our work. And in that process, we really saw, I can hear that. That's bound to happen occasionally. I'm sort of embedded in a vault inside the middle of the building too. So it's
yes.
Bizarre that we can hear that. Okay, I can start where I left off though. So about 20 years into our practice, we started reflecting backwards and working on a monograph project. And it was really an incredible process. That monograph is being published this June with Thames and Hudson. And we, through that process, were really able to survey the sort of environmental contribution throughout, you know, about 10 projects, and could really follow that arc. And we realized that we, you know, had really made substantial sort of efforts and innovation in that space, and can quite kind of proudly look back and say, you know, we're not done, but I feel like definitely we've set out or we've accomplished what I set out to do in that manner.
Do you still have your student's idealism today?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the world is a complex place and, you know, but I think that essentially for the future of our civilization, I think it's, you know, the writing's on the wall that these environmental issues, how we integrate and interact with nature, is really at the core, not only of our own kind of personal well-being, but at, you know, our ability to exist, you know, on this planet. And so I think if anything, that's only become more clear over time. And, you know, the urgency has heightened, I think, to really lead and react to those issues.
Oui.
Pouvez-vous nous parler maintenant? Could you tell us about your approach and work on Skylab's projects?
Skylab.
The emblematic projects and the current projects.
Vous travaillez aujourd'hui.
For example, and about the Serena Williams building. How did you get this project? What can you tell us about the program, its size, the way you treated both the space and the relationship to the environment? How to militate for ecology in such a vast construction?
Yes,
so the Serena Williams building is an amazing experience and opportunity for our company. The way the project had come about is over the years, Skylab has done a number of projects for Nike, and also quite a few projects, residential projects for Nike leadership. And so we have a network of relationships there that have been growing over time and successful projects, and, you know, mostly on the smaller side. But one of our key projects was a house called, at the time it was called the M2 Residence, but it was a speculative home that we constructed. So it was a partnership between a contractor and ourselves, and we designed and constructed a house that didn't have a client for sale. And that home has an interesting story, but the buyer was John Hoke, who's the head of design at Nike. And we became great friends, and we worked on a handful of projects with him. That house also became the home that the vampires live in the Twilight movies, the series of films, The Twilight. So that it's kind of a cult following piece of architecture. But anyway, the Serena Williams Building is a design-focused program, and John is the head of the design at Nike. And so his weight in terms of who he wanted to bring in was quite meaningful. And so he got us an interview, essentially, and we competed with a few other firms and won the project. And at that time, we were on a very steep growth curve. We were in construction on a 400,000 square foot high-rise building here in Portland, a 21-story high-rise, mixed-use apartments and commercial space. And that was our biggest project. And our previous biggest project had been, you know, much smaller, like 50,000 square feet, something like that. And so this new opportunity was for 1 million square feet, which was, you know, three times larger than anything we had designed to that point. And it was going to be quite a Herculean task. And so we set out on that effort in a way very similar to the sort of design methodology that we had set across our projects in general. And initially really built a narrative about, you know, before we started designing, really what was the idea behind the building and what were the goals and aspirations and what was our approach going to be. And there's a lot, Nike has a lot to build on because they have such strong, clear kind of communication around their thoughts around their athletes and their staff. And so we said, well, what if we built a building where we treated the designers like they were athletes? And so how could the building support the designers in their training and competition and recovery through the design cycles? Because if you know the design and, you know, footwear and apparel world, they're on these quarterly delivery cycles. And as soon as you finish one, you're on to the next. And there's no finish line, as Nike likes to say. And so we saw a great opportunity to say, okay, how can a building and the way it's designed, you know, have an impact on its occupants and not only help them create better, and you know, maybe do that through interacting with their peers in a more kind of focused way, but also connect them to nature, connect them to the outdoors, give them spaces that are secure and outdoors to work in, and create an environment that really elevates that experience for them. So that narrative, you know, became sort of the project's North Star. And then when we set out to design the building, one of the things that was great about the project to begin with is its site was essentially surface parking lots for around, I don't know, probably 1,000 cars, maybe more. And so it was a natural site. It had once been a farm. It was adjacent to a wetlands, but it had been paved over. So what better opportunity from a sort of a regenerative design point of view to come in and reclaim the land back from the automobile and from the concrete and, you know, be careful and articulate about how we then restructured the relationship between the built environment and the natural environment. So we started designing the building, and one of the key challenges, a million square feet is around the size of the stadium that the San Francisco 49ers play in. It's a huge amount of space. You know, it's more of like an airport scale kind of program in a way, or a stadium. And so the context of the Nike campus is buildings that are more like three or four, maybe five stories. They're relatively low slung buildings. It's a beautiful campus. It's surrounded by a berm with a running track on it. It's very natural. There's a lot of beautiful trees, old trees that have been preserved. So our primary challenge was, how do we build a building this large without kind of blowing the scale of the environment? And so we came up with a scheme that sort of terraced down the hill. And the idea with the building is that we would capture the rainwater through a series of green roofs and outdoor spaces that were accessible to the studios on each level, and sort of follow the terracing would follow gravity and essentially lead down to the wetlands on the south side of the space site where the sun also was primary. And so that diagram was really important in terms of sort of the sustainability component of the building, and that intersection of, you know, leveraging nature and stormwater and sunlight, and minimizing the scale of the project, and then also connecting the occupants to the outdoors. So that was a key sort of sectional idea. And then in plan, the building is also significant because it's in the shape of it has a sort of a branch form, or we like to refer to it as the wing. So the building starts as a unified a component at a 250 foot tall tower, but then branches out into six unique feathers on the wing, or branches of the tree. And this was very symbolic because we saw it as both a sort of diagram of like how a watershed works and how streams turn to rivers, turn to oceans, but also how individuals come together as a team and then as a company at Nike. So the metaphor of the building layout was very rich. It also was a reference to the wing goddess Nike, which is the the origins of the company's name. And then it culminates in a tower, which is an homage to the company's two founders, Bill Bowerman and Phil Knight. And so they had two different characters. One was a little bit more conservative. One was more progressive. One was more innovation and design focused. One was more sales and marketing focused. And so it enabled us to build a tower that had these sort of two personalities, and then literally locked into a handshake in plan and section. And that tower now is, you know, the tallest building that will be built on campus. It is a symbolic of the founders and of the idea that the company could be formed on a handshake, which is actually inscribed into the cornerstone of the tower.
Incredibly detail-oriented. Can you tell us about the materials
que vous avez employé dans cette architecture?
Yes. Yeah, just quickly, I think it'd be good to talk about Serena herself. So I'll use her to sort of tell the next level of the story here. Early in the design of the project, Serena Williams was brought forward as the namesake of the building. And that was really incredible to us, obviously, because she's such an inspiration. But to know who the building's naming and homage was going to be early in the process really allowed us to study her and her history and really weave her into the narrative of the building. And so one of the things about Serena, at least at Nike, she's known as the princess warrior is how they say it. So that her character possesses both this sort of soft, feminine, warm side, but then also this fierce competitor. And she's able to really go back and forth between those two juxtapositions. And that was really powerful for us in terms of influencing the building's exterior design and material choices. So the program for the building is actually a few parts. It's a underground parking garage. And then on top of that is a merchandising center, which is essentially a shopping mall sized facility to prototype retail environments. And then on top of that are the design studios. And the idea is that you can start with a sketch on the top floor of the building and go through the various phases of product design and end up taking it all the way to how the consumer will experience it in a retail space in the base of the building. And so that end game for us was almost like this vault. It was this thing that was really large and powerful, but it couldn't be seen from the outside. It's essentially the intellectual property vault, so the future of the company. And so we looked at, Serena and her Princess Warrior attributes, but then also back at the history of Nike and its forming through a strong relationship with Japan. And we started looking at the Imperial Palace in Tokyo and how it's this incredible building that sits on this sort of fortress-like crenellated stone base. But then sort of as you get above the fortress is this cantilevered light, very expressive building form. And we essentially took that as a cue for how we wanted to design this building. And so using the princess side of Serena, we actually applied that to the fortress. So we came up with these curving forms that are stone skin. So it's a hard fortress-like material applied in a very soft, flowing manner, almost like one of the dresses she might have worn at a tennis match. And then on top of it sits this, elegant series of forms in the design studio, but they're being inspired almost by a samurai warrior. So for us, we took that, the warrior portion of her personality, and we put it on the higher portions of the building. And that's mostly a sort of smoked titanium metal panel and glazing. But there's quite a lot of effort put into a sort of shingled siding approach and really large cantilevers sort of on all the tips and wings of the building.
So on this note about the Princess Warrior, have you met her, Serena Williams?
Yes. Yeah, she was actually integrated into the design process, which was really great. So early on in the design process, we had a series of meetings with the CEO of Nike, kind of the project team at Nike, and then Serena and her manager. And she was able to, hear a presentation on the design and then react to it. And we were able to take her kind of insights forward. And she's actually quite engaged in the design process at Nike. They have a studio of students that they built around her. And so it was a very natural, step for her to step into, the process around the design of the building. One of the other things is, Nike is takes an extreme effort to really go to a high level of detail in terms of understanding sort of their athletes and what's driving them. And in this case, conducted a series of interviews with Serena to really get her, as much insights as they could into her sort of life story as possible. And that content was extracted and ended up being key, to different ideas that we installed as sort of branded installations throughout the building. So whether that was a, you know, the naming of the auditorium, which is named after her daughter, or in there's a convenience store in a portion of the building, and the whole interiors of the convenience store is inspired by a story about her dad driving around in a Volkswagen bus delivering newspapers, and that was how they made the money to pay for their tennis equipment and time on the court and whatnot. And while he was doing that, he had a history of hitting the mirrors on other people's parked cars and knocking them off the cars. And so there was a statement about that, a sort of a tagline that he used, that was, you know, that they were doing a little bump and ride. And so we introduced his statement, you know, into the room and sort of printed neon text. We collected about 100 mirrors off of old vintage automobiles and made an installation of them on the wall of the store. And then also, built the cash wrap or POS at the store in the form of a newsstand. And so it's taking these sort of subtle clues from her storytelling and then, you know, using them as a way to help spark our creative process and tell her story.
Cette histoire est vraiment...
It's captivating. Can you tell us about other projects that you'd like to mention?
Sure. Yes, Skylab has always been a sort of a non-specialized firm in the sense that we were known to tackle quite a wide array of project types, and people hire us specifically to bring fresh eyes to a problem. And so our work ranges anywhere from... branded retail and environments through custom residences, hospitality, hotels, bars, restaurants, office environments, corporate campuses, and sustainable master planning. And we've even gone as far over the last few years as we've been designing a cruise ship for Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines. And so, you know, can extend the sort of design and approach into a really wide array of projects. For us, there's a few pieces to our design process that are really important. And one of them is we really like to focus on trying to find innovative ways to rethink the construction process. We feel like, you know, the process is challenging and, you know, some would say broken. And so how, through an integrated understanding of, you know, development and construction, how can we design projects that are easier to build, better for the environment, and more economic? And one of the key ways we've done that is through prefabrication of our homes, either delivering, you know, unitized buildings and building them up modularly, or really focusing on prefabricated structural systems that are really fast and quick to erect and easy to procure. And so that has led us into mass timber design, which has been a really great addition to kind of our toolkit. We've executed a handful of buildings using cross-laminated timber, and everything from a ski lodge to a downtown building here in Portland. And, you know, currently we're working on a very innovative house project where there's a local company here called Ferez, and they historically had been a plywood manufacturer and plant. And they were really intrigued by what they were seeing in the cross-laminated timber world. So they essentially developed a new product called Mass Plywood, which is an approach to heavy timber that uses, you know, the same laminations that you'll find in a plywood rather than, veneers rather than, you know, 2x6s. And so it's a really interesting process. It's more of a scalpel than a hammer in terms of how you can design the structures with this material. You can really tune the use of wood to a very exacting level. So you can use less material to solve the structural needs. And it also is more of a fast growing product. So it uses younger trees and it's more of a renewable resource. And so we've had a lot of issues with forest fires here on the West Coast of the United States. So there's been drought and our summertime, our fire season has really become a major issue. And so we had a fire two summers ago that burned down the cabin, the fishing cabin that the owners of this company had built and renovated. And it was a really important piece of their lives. And so they said, well, what if we replaced it, you know, demonstrating how our mass plywood could be used. And so we, in partnership with them, have developed a really, you know, innovative residential design, harvesting this new material and really being able to express it as the finish. You know, so when you're in the building, the structure is the sort of skin and experience of the interiors. And it can be, you know, deployed sort of quickly, and it's a renewable resource, and it's quite a great sort of statement about regenerative growth after an event like a forest fire. So I'm quite excited about that project and how it kind of demonstrates not only sustainability, but just an innovative implementation of construction practice.
Merci.
Thank you.
How
does the Skylab agency in Portland interact with the city itself?
That's a great question. So we work nationally and internationally. So always a percentage of our work is here in Portland, but a significant portion is remote. And so balancing those two aspects has always been really interesting. So we like to stay very engaged in the city and the community, and you know, a lot of the venues that we've built here are culturally significant for the city's you know, food and beverage, live music events, cultural places, things like that, parks. So what we're really excited about right now is that we are in construction on a new headquarters for Skylab, and the headquarters is going to be a bit of a creative compound. So its program is design studios. It has outdoor gardens. It has a outdoor event space that can hold around 400 people, and it'll have a fabrication space where we can prototype everything from, you know, furniture to building facades to prefabricated products, meaning buildings and cabins, and even do test build outs of things like, you know, hotel rooms or apartments and mock-ups and things like that. And so we're really investing heavily in this kind of compound that we think is going to be a very key kind of influential space for the city itself. The event portion of this, where we really see as that key interface. So we're building a set of content that, you know, is anything from live music to film, outdoor cinema, to lectures and events, and you know, really limitless, and could even be things just like art installations and whatnot. And so it's going to be sort of a canvas for us to paint on for the next, you know, 10, 20 years, and really build a much more sort of a physical venue for us to host cultural events for the city. And we feel like that's going to be a huge contribution forward that, you know, will hopefully help our city, you know, build on its leadership position globally as a sort of both creative and environmental steward.
How are the Skylab teams structured?
So Skylab, we're about 30 people, and the breakdown is roughly 20 architects, 5 interior designers, and sort of 5 administrative and sales and, you know, marketing roles. The creative team structure is we're sort of sized in a way where I'm the design director here, and we have as many teams and as many projects as essentially we can accommodate with that sort of consistent role and my time. Each project has a project director, a project lead that, you know, is essentially moving the project along through all of its various phases, organizing the consultant teams, organizing the client interaction. And then we build a specific project team for each team that usually, you know, at a minimum has a project designer that's an architect and an interior designer. And we don't see there being a big distinction between interior design and architecture. I mean, we see like the architectural materials as, you know, essentially an integral part of the interior design palette and vice versa. And so we really elevate that aspect of the projects and very early start looking at, you know, not only building the narrative for the story, you know, the story of the project, but then how the tools and texture or the materials and textures can start to bring that story to life. And even taking it to, you know, the furniture and integrated brand and graphics and signage and that level. And so it's a very integrated approach, top to bottom, everything from, you know, innovative structural design all the way down to, you know, the detail level. And then I think another really important piece for us is the landscape piece and how the landscape integrates. We don't have an in-house landscape architecture yet. It's something that we're really looking at building right now. But we do, I guess, play a large role in that process now in those collaborations.
Okay.
What do you think is the perception of French architecture by American professionals? I admit it can be a tricky question.
We love it.
Oh, thank you.
I don't know that I could answer that like specifically to French architects necessarily, but European architecture in general is extremely influential. And, you know, I look at it often and really try to follow, you know, what the innovations and the approach kind of throughout Europe, because it really... There is a very strong leadership there from both a technical and sort of a conceptual vantage point. And there's I think because space is so limited and history is so long, there is a much more quality focused approach to buildings, even sort of the infill kind of fabric buildings, you know, that I see in Europe are just being delivered at a really high quality level generally. And that's really inspiring for us, as you know, like in America, you know, there's great architecture here, but I think there's really, it's a relatively small percentage of the amount of buildings that get built are really design focused. And so, you know, we're trying to change that. And I think looking to Europe as an inspiration there has always been, you know, a very kind of a clear approach.
Today, the balance of the world seems very precarious. However, architects develop long-term projects. What do you say to yourself each morning at the beginning of your day to continue tracing the path? How could you enlighten someone about the world we live in?
Yeah. So I spend a lot of time thinking about this topic. And one of the things that I've realized is that, you know, buildings are only one piece of architecture. You know, architecture also is the space, the negative space in between the buildings. It's the, whether that's, you know, the urban landscape or it's the natural environment. It's really the combination of all of these elements that is what we should be studying and understanding and looking to rebalance in terms of a more successful approach to creating a sustainable life expectancy on the planet. And so I think a lot about the act of removing as much as I do the act of building and adding and the act of editing and looking at, okay, what have we done, you know, to our spaces and, you know, how can we restore them or fix them or, you know, take them in a different direction. And I think as we move forward, we're going to see a lot more of those opportunities. Like for, you know, something I like to think about right now is, you know, as automobiles move from gas to electric, you know, for example, what are we going to do with all of our gas stations? You know, and, you know, here they're everywhere and they're going to be quite a, you know, an opportunity to sort of, you know, not only from a environmental cleanup point of view, but also just from a conceptual point of view, like how do we take advantage of those opportunities to sort of set a new, more optimistic path forward?
On the subject, at Skylab, how do you imagine the world of tomorrow?
I think for me, you know, that really goes to how I define regenerative design, which is collaborating with nature in our design projects and our design solutions. And I feel like if we focus on that piece and we approach each project with that through that lens, I think the future looks like one that's a more balanced outcome between humanity and the natural world. And I think you can do that in every situation, whether that's, you know, building something in an urban environment or, you know, sort of taking over or redeveloping industrial zone or even inserting something new into a natural zone. I think a real focus on that balance, you know, is my hope in terms of where the future of design goes. And I think we're seeing that quite a bit across the design landscape now.
Thank you so much. What advices would you give to architecture students today?
So I think the role of architect is, you know, particularly in a lead role, is much more broad than just design. And so I think, you know, my career it's been important that I've learned to do construction. It's been important that I learned to do development. It's been important that I've had the craft in terms of drawing and model making and design. And, you know, it's an amalgamation of all those skills that I offer my clients. And so, you know, we might be writing a pro forma on a development project and integrating that in our design process, or we might be taking on the fabrication of one of our projects because it's too complex for a typical contractor to maybe get their head around. And so that sort of fluency across disciplines is something I would really encourage young architects to develop.
Okay.
Formidable. Merci. This was Jeff Covell of Skylab for Comdarchi. Thank you, Jeff, and goodbye.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chers auditeurs,
dear listeners, thank you for tuning in. Let's meet again next week for a new Comdarchi in English.
Et d'ici là,
and until then,
prenez soin de vous.
Take care of yourselves. Goodbye.
Au revoir.
Thank you for listening. Thanks to Julien Rebourg, sound engineer, who is collaborating with us today. Don't forget to tune in to our previews on Instagram at Comme d'Archi Podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, don't hesitate to promote it by giving it 5 stars and a little comment on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast platform. And above all, subscribe to listen to all of our episodes for free. See you soon, and until then, take care of yourself.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.